This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. Last year, Texas Governor Greg Abbott signed into law House Bill 20. It bans large social media platforms from censoring content based on a user's viewpoint. The Texas law was quickly followed by lawsuits, arguing that the state had no right to dictate a private company's editorial discretion. Rulings from the lower court sided with that opposition. But earlier this month, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit overturned the lower court rulings and upheld the Texas law. Following the ruling, Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton said, quote, "Big Tech's reign of endless censorship and their suppression of conservative viewpoints is coming to an end. These massive corporate entities cannot continue to go unchecked as they silence the voices of millions of Americans," end quote. But what happens in Texas does not necessarily stay in Texas. Constitutional law attorney Scott Keller made that point when he argued on behalf of the plaintiff, NetChoice, during oral arguments in May.
Today we're talking about the Texas legislature, but the same theory could be exported to talk about the federal government, a federal agency, the state of California, and the state of Massachusetts. That's not a road that this court or this country should go down.
So this hour, On Point, we'll ask, what will this law mean for social media platforms? And what impact could this law have on the future of online content moderation across the nation? Joining us now is Alan Rosenstein. He's associate professor at the University of Minnesota Law School and a senior editor at Lawfare. Alan, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
So give us an overview of HB 20. What does this law in Texas actually do?
So what the law purports to do, and that may be different than what the law actually does, but what the law purports to do is to limit the ability of the biggest social media platforms from, we can call it censoring, we could call it moderating, there's kind of no value-neutral description, from removing content posted by users based on, quote-unquote, their viewpoint. That's the core of what the law does. In addition, the law imposes some transparency requirements on platforms so that they publicly disclose how they're moderating. It requires platforms to set up processes for users to appeal content removals. Those are a little less controversial, but the core and what's gotten the most attention, and rightfully so, is this restriction on the moderation based on, quote unquote, viewpoint.
And it doesn't target every social media platform, right? It has to have at least 50 million users. So this is really targeted to the big ones, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, etc., correct?
That's right. That's right. And there may be partisan motives for that, but also it's a pretty common feature of law that sometimes you just choose to regulate the biggest entities because they're the ones that can afford it, and that's where you get the biggest bang for the buck.
So first, I want to talk about the practicality of this. This is not the usual purview of a state law to try to regulate just within a state how these worldwide platforms work. That's right.
It's not clear how you could have a patchwork system of state regulations on these big platforms, which are not just national, but global. If Texas has its requirements and Florida, which passed a similar law, has its requirements, but then California or Massachusetts has opposite requirements, there's no obvious way for platforms to run different moderation systems for different users without potentially breaking up the platforms into state-based versions or possibly even having the platforms just withdraw from some jurisdictions. You know, if this law fully goes into effect, it's a possibility that the platforms decide that, well, we just can't operate in Texas, and so they have to block Texas users. This is one reason why some legal observers, myself included, you know, think that behind this law is lurking some real constitutional issues beyond just potential First Amendment problems, and that has to do with the ability of states to regulate companies that do business across state lines because of the potential disruptive effects that that could have on the national economy.
So we're going to dig into the legalities of this in just a moment. But just back to how this law works, who enforces it? Would it be someone who is perhaps blocked from one of these sites or kicked off one of these sites that can bring suit? Would it be the state of Texas, the attorney general that would bring an action? How would it work?
So either of those. So the statute provides that either a user who believes that they or their content has been removed unlawfully, or the Attorney General of Texas could bring a lawsuit against the companies. There's no provision for damages. So you can't sue for money, though you can sue for attorney's fees. But the real main remedy is that a user or the state of Texas can ask a court to require the companies to reinstate a user or reinstate content.
So during oral arguments on May 9th, Texas Assistant Solicitor General Ryan Bash, who briefed for the state, said HB 20 was about regulating the platform's ability to suppress speech.
These social media platforms control the modern day public square, but they abusively suppress speech in that square. Texas responded to the platform's speech suppression with HB 20.
HB 20 bans large social media platforms from moderating content based on the viewpoint of the user. It's a point that conservatives have long made, that big tech companies who host the social media platforms have an anti-conservative bias. In fact, last year, before HB 20, Texas Governor Greg Abbott signed a Senate bill that aimed to put similar limitations on social media companies.
These social media tech companies are using their tools to silence conservative speech on their platforms. Senator Hughes's bill, Senate Bill 12, protects Texans from being wrongfully censored on social media, making sure that their voices are going to be heard and not canceled or silenced.
SB 12 targeted platforms with 100 million or more monthly users. HB 20 reduced that number to 50 million. Alan, why do you think that is? And is there any evidence besides the most obvious example that former President Donald Trump was unable to use Twitter after some comments, some posts that he made after January 6th? Is there actual evidence of an anti-conservative bias on the part of these companies?
So I'm not sure why the size of the companies was changed. But with respect to the kind of question of is there conservative, anti-conservative bias, it's very hard to know. There's no question that plenty of conservatives are censored, if you want to put it that way, on big tech companies, but plenty of liberals are censored as well. And plenty of conservatives have done awfully well on social media. In fact, a large reason why we've seen, you know, the growth of a lot of kind of conservative media is because of their ability to leverage social media. And of course, social media has incentives not to censor the views that millions of Americans find interesting. At the end of the day, these are for-profit companies that run on user engagement, as they say, and advertisement. So it's just not even in their interest to systematically censor one side of the political spectrum or another. Now, there have, again, been some high-profile incidents, and I do think Twitter and Facebook kicking Trump off their platforms in the wake of the January 6th attack on the Capitol was quite controversial, frankly, among all sorts of folks, not just conservatives. And in addition, I think there is a perception, and I think this is true, that at least culturally, the companies themselves, you know, their employees, they are certainly to the left of the median American, certainly to the left of the median Texan. Again, though, I'm not sure that translates into systematic censorship of conservatives. What I do think you can probably say is that the technology companies are trying to build platforms that appeal to a wide swath of Americans. And therefore, they are probably erring on the side of censoring when you get to the extreme of public opinion. And here, I do think that to the extent that conservatives have polarized in the last decade more so than liberals. This is political scientists call this asymmetric polarization. Perhaps maybe there's more censorship of conservative views. But again, just to emphasize the empirical premise of a lot of these laws, that there's some anti-conservative censorship on a broad scale relative to anti-liberal censorship, that very much remains to be proven.
Now, even irrespective of whether or not there is this bias, Alan, is there a case to be made that better regulation is needed, particularly for these big tech companies that platform a lot of people, that the rules about what content can be restricted and why should be clearer?
I certainly think so. I am not someone who reflexively opposes government efforts to regulate, put some guardrails around what these large tech companies can do, because the state of Texas is right when it says that these companies control the digital public square, that these are some of the most important forums for communication in modern society. And I think that it is at the very least questionable to leave these monumentally important decisions to large private companies that operate entirely, you know, that operate according to the imperatives of the free market. Now, I'm not saying that there should be total regulation. The devil is in the details, as it is with so many issues of tech policy and law. So I certainly think there's some room. I don't think the Texas law does a very good job, though.
So how do you make those changes? I mean, I was in journalism school 20 years ago, and we were talking about how the current regulations don't meet up with the ever-changing technology. Is that up to Congress? Is it up to who should be making these rules? Should we leave it to the companies themselves?
Well, so, you know, if the companies can come up with good rules, I think that's fine. Often the way to get companies to do something is to threaten regulation. If at the end of the day, the regulation, quote unquote, comes from the companies themselves rather than the law, kind of who cares? But at the very least, I think the relevant party here should be Congress, not the states. Again, because you cannot have a patchwork of state laws. So I don't support state laws trying to limit what companies can moderate. I also don't support state laws on the other side trying to force companies to remove electoral misinformation or vaccine information. I just think this is not an issue for states to do.
All right, we're going to have now, Alan hold right there. We're discussing the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals decision to uphold the Texas law that could strip social media companies of their editorial discretion and what implications it may have on the future of content moderation online. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. Today, we're discussing the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals decision to uphold a Texas law that might strip large social media companies of their editorial discretion and what implications it may have on the future of content moderation online. With us is Alan Rosenstein. He's associate professor at the University of Minnesota Law School. And joining us now is Julie Owono. She's executive director at Internet Without Borders and Stanford's Content Policy and Society Lab. She's also an inaugural member of the Meta Oversight Board and an affiliate at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard. Julie, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Kimberly. Hello.
So I want to talk to you about HB 20, this Texas law, and get your take on what happens when state laws step in and try to regulate global social media companies on a state level.
Yes. Well, what is obvious is that this law and the recent opinion of the Fifth Circuit, well, are outliers in the debate on content moderation. And of course, the First Amendment in Section 230 that created this limited liability regime for companies providing interactive computer services and leaving them the breathing space to decide what to leave up and what to take down on their spaces. Now, it creates an interesting moment in content moderation discussion where you have increasingly state-level legislation. We've discussed that. And if we take things a little bit further, there are broader conversations at the federal level, at national level in the United States, about what content should be left up and what content should be taken down, what allegedly liberal social media companies, how they're biased against certain opinions and how that's not okay in society. What I think is important here is that the Texas and the Florida law, whether we agree with them or not, the foundational question that they ask is it okay in a modern democratic society where we express our opinions freely on public spaces such as social media platforms? Well, is it okay to leave to private companies the decision on what we can say or not? And is it okay to continue with this perception of arbitrariness that exists today with regards to how those decisions are made? And is it okay not to have more, disclosures from those companies on how they do content moderation? Well, these are very foundational questions, but in my very personal opinion as a researcher here, the answer here by Texas and Florida's law is probably misguided. Probably if we took a bit of hate and asked ourselves, is there a way to democratically do content moderation? I think that is the foundational question. And certainly at state level, there was a missed opportunity to provide answers. Now, I'm part of the Meta Oversight Board, and what we do is precisely not allow only those private companies, and particularly Facebook and Instagram, make those decisions behind closed door. What we do is that we publish very regularly decisions on cases that involve content that was taken down, user content taken down. And one of the most famous cases, of course, involved the access to his accounts of former President Donald Trump. And what I find interesting in the work that we do is that we basically provide a framework on how to explain to a company like Facebook how to treat its users more fairly, how to get rid of the perception of arbitrariness. And this starts with having very clear rules. This starts with being transparent. This starts with accountability. So this is what the Meta Oversight Board tries to provide. We do not base ourselves on national laws. We're not looking at that, but rather what we do is, again, take a little bit of hate and remind ourselves what are these foundational human rights that are so important and that should be enforced by a company like Meta. And Meta has committed itself to respect human rights. So this is what we do. And I think that's where the conversation now should go and not stay focused on what content should stay up, what content should be taken down, but rather what are the accountability processes? What is the transparency mechanism to ensure that we can restore trust and get rid of that feeling of and perception of arbitrariness from social media platforms?
Alan, I want to go to you on this idea of oversight boards within organizations like Meta, which our listeners may know as Facebook. Is that a solution to try to prevent states from having to step in and take actions such as in Texas and Florida?
I certainly think it's a good step. I will admit a little skeptical that it can ever be a total solution for two reasons. The first is that an oversight board, although it is in many ways independent, it is still fundamentally relies on Facebook's voluntary compliance. You know, at the end of the day, there's nothing stopping Facebook from ignoring the ignoring the orders of the board or disbanding the board. Now, Facebook has real reputational reasons not to do so, and the board, I think, has been quite successful within its mandate. But at the end of the day, an oversight board, even if it is independent, is still an example of self-regulation. And I do think self-regulation, for it to be effective, needs to have at least a credible threat of government enforcement behind it. The other concern I have is that although the oversight board needs to impose and apply some substantive set of laws. Now, this oversight board is trying to use international human rights law, which is great. But of course, different jurisdictions, different nations have different views on what is appropriate and what is not appropriate. You know, the United States has certain general ideas of what free expression requires. Europe has different ideas. Different regions, different countries might have their own ideas. And so again, if we're trying to make sure that these companies are democratically accountable because they control one of the most important pieces of democratic infrastructure, the digital public square. I think that things like oversight boards are great and they should definitely be part of the solution. But I would be surprised if they could be the whole solution.
And Julie, isn't it important to define what we're talking about here, define our terms? You were describing democratic content moderation sort of in the idea of a public square in which, you know, we think about in terms of First Amendment principles. But is that what these platforms are? Are they something more akin to a carrier like a phone company or a utility? And doesn't that matter in terms of the content moderation?
That's a very important question. While the Fifth Circuit opinion says the opposite and basically says that any states in the United States can designate entities as what we call common carriers, so entities that transport informational and communications good in the case of social media platforms. Well, that analysis has been contradicted by, the different analysts, including in the in NetChoice's, documents and positions, simply because social media platforms, for many of them, do not satisfy all the requirements to be considered common carriers, according to those analysis. One example is for Facebook, for instance, if you're under 13 years old, you're not supposedly, allowed to use the platform. You should be over 13 years old. And the company increasingly, despite huge criticism, including from civil society organizations, increasingly, verifies that by asking you to provide government official ID to prove your identity and sometimes your age. So the common carriers analysis is probably has been, criticized heavily, and also by the 11th Circuit opinion in Florida. But I wanted to briefly, probably respond to some of the elements that have been discussed previously, which is the reference to international human rights law. Yes, this framework, which stems from all this body of conventions that have been signed by virtually all the states in the world at some point in history where humanity thought it was important to reaffirm dignity of all humans. Well, when you look at it, and that has been a very interesting exercise for me, there are some analogous principles with even the First Amendment in the U.S. Constitution. For instance, restrictions of rights, and particularly restrictions of speech, have to be very clear. They must not be vague on the one hand. On the other hand, and they should also pursue legitimate aim and must be necessary and strictly proportionate to what the legitimate aim to be achieved requires. So all this to say that while this might seem like a unattainable objective, international human rights, well, it's a consensus. It's a moment in history where many states in the world agree that we will not, interfere with freedoms, and particularly freedom of expression, freedom of speech, in a manner that is arbitrary. And I think that is where the addition of the oversight board might be interesting.
Alan, I want to give you a chance to respond to that. And also the idea of how do we classify these social media platforms? They don't seem to fit in any of these categories: public square, common carrier, utility, something else. Does something else need to be created?
Yeah, I mean, I think something else does need to be created. One of the tricky things that we're dealing with in this debate, and this is something that happens actually very frequently whenever you have new technology, is that we, whether we're lawyers or policy people, we try to take the existing categories and ram the new technology into one of them. And sometimes you can do it, and sometimes even if it's not a perfect fit, it's okay. But in other cases, you just realize that the technology has outstripped the categories that exist, and you have to kind of start from scratch, or at the very least, you have to start from first principles. And I think that the big social media platforms are a perfect example of this. We've developed all sorts of different approaches. Common carriers is one model. Newspapers are another model. And if you use the newspaper model, then the First Amendment really prevents the government from doing much, if anything, in controlling content moderation. But then you can think of, well, maybe it's a public square model. So, for example, a big shopping mall that allows anyone to come in, basically. And if it's the social media companies are thought of as digital shopping malls of a certain kind, then Supreme Court precedent does, in fact, allow governments to require or governments to limit content moderation. The problem is that these companies, they're none of those things. They're a legitimately new thing. They share a lot of properties with previous types of technology and previous categories, but they prevent their own complications, which is, I think, is why, rather than try to say, well, they're like newspapers, or they're like common carriers, or they're like this, or they're like that, we just should engage in a detailed, fact-based analysis of what is it that they're doing, what is the government, you know, what is it that we don't like that they're doing, what is the government's proposed solution, and does it work? Is it proportional? And so I think focusing on the details of the actual platforms and the details of the actual legislative proposals just makes more sense and is more fruitful and more useful than trying to stick square pegs into round holes, which is really what a lot of the debate has been so far.
And Alan, talk a little bit about how the details of these laws in Texas and Florida work. Would only residents of Florida and Texas, respectively, be able to challenge these rules, or only their attorneys general? And how would that work practically?
Well, so the laws are quite different. So the Texas law, I think one way to characterize it is it's broader in the sense that it applies to all users, whereas
okay, Julie, I'm going to throw that question to you while we work to get Alan back. How would this piecemeal, these piecemeal laws work practically,
right,
when they're coming from two states?
Right. That is the implementation question, that the probably $1 million implementation question. Well, first of all, as it was rightly reminded when the show started, is that those platforms operate virtually globally. That is to say, anywhere in the United States, they do not have borders. They're virtual borders. So and what is interesting also is that those two laws, and the Texas bill particularly, does prevent the companies from practicing geofencing. So that means basically tailoring the platform so that geographically you wouldn't see what is not allowed, or you would see what is allowed or what is mandated by your state legislation. So that legislation doesn't allow it. So practically, how do you continue to apply First Amendment rights in other states? Because that's the conclusion of this opinion. There is no First Amendment in for social media companies anymore in Texas. So how do you continue to apply this dual regime while not geofencing? That is going to be a very interesting conversation. One of a great researchers here at Stanford University, Daphne Keller, was also alluding to possibilities for social media platforms to offer possibility to users to tailor their experience so that they could switch on a button and say, okay, I want to see this. I want to see everything that's allowed, or I don't want to see anything that's harmful.
Yeah.
That's technically complicated, frankly. And that also plays into this splinternet idea. I don't know if, you know, listeners know this concept, which says basically internet is not borderless anymore. It's not open as it was before. Now we have virtual borders, including user experience borders that make your experience very different from that of your neighbor or that of the next state or that of neighboring government. So that's interesting.
And Julie, I want to get your response to the point that Alan made, that even though having these oversight boards are a part of the solution, there really needs to be some sort of regulatory teeth behind these companies ensuring that they abide even by their own rules.
What is sure is that the oversight board, the Meta oversight board, certainly will not solve all the things that are complicated right now with social media platforms. What we do, again, is to provide, to make binding decisions on content moderation decisions by Facebook and Instagram. And we also make recommendations that, while not
not binding to the company, nevertheless opened this question on this conversation on content moderation processes and practices. Why? Because Meta has to respond to our recommendations. For instance, when we told them, well, as a company, you need to make sure all your users understand your enforcement rules. Yeah. Well, now the company has decided to do that and to notify users that they will, what rule they violated.
I'm going to pause you right there. We're discussing how a Texas law could impact First Amendment rights and content moderation online. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. Next week, we're going to be hearing how doctors looking to better understand long COVID are turning to researchers of chronic fatigue syndrome for help. If you subscribe to the On Point newsletter, you'll know that already. It's easy to get in the know. Just head to onpointradio.org and click where it says sign up. Today, we're discussing the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals decision to uphold a Texas law that might strip large social media companies of their editorial discretion and what implications it may have on the future of content moderation online. With us is Alan Rosenstein. He's associate professor at the University of Minnesota Law School, and Julia Wono. She's executive director at Internet Without Borders and Stanford's Content Policy and Society Lab. So I want to talk about what the future of this case could look like as it heads up toward the Supreme Court. Here again is Ryan Bash, who argued on behalf of the state during the May oral argument.
The primary question in this case is whether HB 20's hosting rule complies with the First Amendment. It does, Your Honors, for two core reasons. First, the hosting rule regulates only the platform's conduct, not their speech, namely by preventing them from engaging in viewpoint discrimination against their users. Second, even if you think the hosting rule does regulate the platform's speech, the rule is a valid common carriage regulation like many others that have been constitutionally applied to similar businesses for over a century.
So, Alan, at that argument before the Fifth Circuit, some of the points that we've already talked about have come up, whether it's a common carrier, the First Amendment implications. I want to dive into that a little deeper. But first, how likely do you think this case could end up at the U.S. Supreme Court?
I think it's very likely. Either this case or the Florida case, or probably most likely a combination of the case of the two cases. And this is for two reasons. First, this is just a matter of immense public, social, economic importance. And that's one reason for the court to hear the case. And the other is there is now a circuit split, a disagreement between the Fifth Circuit, which is upholding a law like this, and the 11th Circuit, which struck down a law. And so where there's a circuit split over such a core legal question, that's another reason for the court to hear it. And then finally, the court has signaled in previous cases with opinions from folks like Justice Alito and Justice Thomas that they're very interested in this and that there's potentially some disagreement on the court. So this is, again, I think something the court is going to want to hear. Whether they do it now, in the next 12 months, 18 months, 2 years, not entirely clear. There are some procedural issues. Yes, I think this will be resolved by the Supreme Court one way or the other relatively soon.
And Alan, I want you to talk a little bit about this first issue that Bash was talking about, the First Amendment issue, which he says turns on whether this regulates conduct or speech. First of all, do you think that it regulates content or speech? And also, why is that important?
So conduct versus speech is one of these categories that exists in the First Amendment. It's a way of trying to make the law a little more tractable. But the problem is there's no clear distinguishing feature between conduct and speech. Plenty of conduct has expressive effects. And that is absolutely true when platforms exercise their editorial discretion. And in fact, there's a very famous case from the 1970s, a case called Miami Herald versus Tornillo, which is the main First Amendment case at issue here, in which the Supreme Court struck down a state law that required a newspaper to allow politicians to respond to negative coverage in those newspapers. And the Supreme Court in that case said, and has not overruled it since, and it has quoted it, you know, several times since then, so we think it's still good law, is that the exercise of editorial discretion is protected for First Amendment purposes. Now, you can call it conduct, you can call it speech, you can call it some other thing. Again, it's important not to get too hung up on the technical labels and overlook the core point that when a newspaper or presumably a platform exercises editorial discretion in choosing what to host on its platform, it is doing something that is protected by the First Amendment. And the real question, I think, is, well, how much is it protected by the First Amendment? No protection is absolute. And what laws can be compatible with the protections that the First Amendment affords? But I don't think, and here I disagree with the state of Texas and I disagree with the Fifth Circuit opinion, I don't think you can get around that by just calling what the companies are doing conduct or calling it censorship. That begs the whole question of whether or not what they're doing is protected by the First Amendment.
And Julie, I want to turn to you about the second point that Bash made about this being a, quote, valid common carriage regulation, even if the court does find that it is a regulation of speech. We're back to this common carriage idea. What do you think about that argument?
If we think about the implications, of course, in the United States and even beyond, it's important to think about those. Personally, as a Black woman, as a mother, I am persuaded that there are things that I feel comfortable I don't see today, and I'm sure there are many others in this case. And even if you think about the fact that, well, let's remember those are U.S. companies and there is an international context, and the U.S. also has a very significant position in that international context. Well, if we agree that social media companies are common carriers, we agree that anything can be online. But let's remember that this is precisely the argument that is used by regimes that want to make sure that none of these U.S. companies are available anymore on their in their countries by saying all of these companies are coming in with those terrible content. They're doing nothing about it, taking no responsibility about it. That affects us. So we need to do real censorship. That is to say, as government, we should tell them, we should put them out of our countries. We have to think about the implications here, frankly. And that is why, again, let's take a little bit of height, and think about the democratic implications. Think about creatively how we can put back democracy, rule of law at the center of content moderation debates. That, I think, would be a very valuable contribution from the United States. And this is a research area that I'm particularly interested in exploring, at the different affiliations that I have, and which I think should be the central debate as we go forward in the United States and also around the world. So, yeah.
And Alan, this case has already gone to the Supreme Court in a limited way on an application to vacate a stay. That's not binding law, and the Supreme Court rejected that application. But what can we read from the tea leaves, particularly from what Justice Alito said dissenting from that decision?
I think it's really hard to make predictions here. I think, and I've called this a loose ball in constitutional law, which is to say, I think this is one of these rare issues in constitutional law, especially in our polarized time, where it's really unclear what the answer is going to be. I think you have a lot of justices who think a lot of different things, and they don't fall neatly into ideological camps. So you mentioned Justice Alito. We could add Justice Thomas, maybe Justice Gorsuch. I'm not sure. Conservatives who one would think, based on the traditional conservative approach, would be very friendly to big business in opposing government regulation. But Justice Alito and Justice Thomas have expressed, at least they've suggested, that they might support some sort of regulation. by contrast, Justice Kavanaugh in particular, I think has made it pretty clear, both in his decisions as a Supreme Court justice, but also in his decisions earlier as a judge on the D.C. Appellate Court, that he would not support these decisions. And then as to the liberals, it's a really tricky question. On the one hand, I think they're very, they are and should be very skeptical of laws from Texas and Florida as, frankly, not particularly good faith attempts to deal with this issue. On the other hand, they have their own reasons to try to limit the ability of technology companies and corporations in general to invoke the First Amendment as a powerful deregulatory tool to strike down government laws. So I have no idea. I mean, if I had to guess, I would guess that these laws will not survive at the Supreme Court, but that the Supreme Court will also cut back on some of the what I think are extravagant claims that the companies are making, that the First Amendment completely insulates them from any sort of government regulation of their content moderation practices.
So I want to talk a little bit about, aside from these particular laws and all of the issues and potential problems that they have, about what solutions can look like when it comes to a way to moderate content without abridging anyone's rights, but at the same time holding social media platforms accountable for potentially harmful information that it can pause. I'm going to go to you, Julie. What's the starting point for some reasonable regulations that tech companies can take or that Congress can impose that would walk the line between all of the concerns we've been discussing?
Yes, well, preaching from my own church, of course, I think the work of the Meta Oversight Board might be interesting and has already probably can inspire regulation, including, in Europe, for instance, where very soon a bill called the Digital Services Act will now ask social media companies, digital services, to have appeals mechanisms for users to be able to voice discontent. This is a very important step, and this is something that we've been doing at the board for the past 2 years, again, analyzing how to do that in a proportionate way, in a way that is not arbitrary. And broader, probably a vision of what could be done is, yes, trying to find the equivalent of, of all the rule of law, checks and balances mechanisms that we have in our very physical spaces, how to make sure that these also apply online. And this doesn't only concern social media companies. If we think about it, frankly, and that was said previously in the conversation, technology evolves very rapidly. So there are chances that much of the energy that we spend on focusing on the way social media platforms are functioning now may not even apply to what's coming. And I'm thinking about innovations around Web3, this re-decentralized web that many are calling for, or even the metaverse that we are increasingly hearing about. How do these laws apply to those particular innovations? That is why, again, how to transport the rule of law, democracy conversation to those virtual spaces so that any innovation that comes today, tomorrow, will have to respect this, and we will probably lose less energy on being polarized on, what content, what individual can and should be allowed to speak online.
Ellen, what do you think? Can we look to the laws in Europe, and how, to Julie's point, can regulators stay ahead instead of trailing behind where the technology is?
Sure. I mean, so with respect to Europe, I mean, I think we can always look to other jurisdictions. I'm skeptical that Europe can be a model for us for a number of reasons. First, I think it does matter that these technology companies are in the United States rather than Europe. I think that matters for two reasons. The first is Europe's values are different than the United States' values. I'm not saying they're worse. I'm not saying they're better, but they're just different. Europe does not have the same sort of extensive free speech protections that the United States does. And this is a choice that Europe has made. Again, I'm not criticizing it, but different polities can make these democratic choices. And so I think it's problematic to impose, frankly, any jurisdiction's law globally. Also, I think Europe is acting from the position of not worrying, frankly, quite as much about innovation, because again, these are not companies that originate from Europe. They originate from the United States. And while I don't think innovation should be a get out of free card from government regulation, I think it's a relevant consideration. You know, as to how we proceed, I mean, I think there are a couple of factors to consider. The first is I think it's really important to get the legal framework right. So one thing that I've been arguing as the Florida and Texas cases have been winding through the courts is that we should avoid what I've been calling First Amendment absolutism. We should avoid either the position that the companies take, that the First Amendment protects them from almost all government regulation. We should also avoid the position that the states take, that the First Amendment just isn't implicated here because this is quote unquote censorship, not speech. I think you have to take an intermediate position, and there exists precedent for that, in which you just take a more fact-based inquiry and balance the various interests at stake and be flexible. And that's important because, as Julie points out, technology is innovating at a very rapid pace, and policymakers need to be able to experiment, need to be able to try new things as it goes along. Now, I do suspect that ultimately procedural requirements, things, for example, like transparency mandates, mandates for appeals, mandates maybe even that companies and platforms be forced to interoperate, so share data with other platforms so that you can avoid some of the monopolistic behavior that I think is heightening the stakes of all these content moderation issues are really important. And then finally, I think it's also important just to level set our expectations properly. We will never, quote unquote, solve this problem, just as we will never solve the problem of debate in a pluralistic society. This is a big country. It's a big world. Lots of people think different things. People have very different views, and you're always going to make a lot of people unhappy. So the point is not to come to some final resolution, because that's never going to happen. The point is to come to a compromise agreement that can be stable over some time. And although I don't generally feel too bad for these giant trillion-dollar tech companies, I also don't envy them. It is a hard place to be in, and they're not going to, quote-unquote, solve this problem anytime soon, if ever, frankly.
Well, Julie, as one of the people tasked with trying to solve this problem, do you think that sort of intermediate position where it's not an absolutist view of the First Amendment, as Ellen said, is possible?
Recent history has shown, and I'm thinking specifically here about January the 6th riots, that the absolutism in any way and on this debate is probably not the best way forward. Many companies agree with that also today, very frankly. Recently, I was part of the Trust and Safety conference that is organized by a very new organization called the Trust and Safety Professional Association. So trust and safety professionals are those who internally within companies create and enforce those rules around what is allowed, what is not allowed on the platforms. And yes, quite frankly, it is increasingly difficult for them to let anything on the platform, because that creates very real harm on our society. So absolutism definitely not, from my perspective, the way forward. And yes, there is room for experiment and alternative and probably intermediate positions on that.
Julie Owono is the executive director at Internet Without Borders and Stanford's Content Policy and Society Lab. She's also an inaugural member of the Meta Oversight Board. Julie, it was great having you on the show today.
Thank you very much.
Alan Rosenstein is associate professor at the University of Minnesota Law School and a senior editor at Lawfare. Thanks for joining us, Alan.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.